Charles, you begin your book with a fascinating story about a guy named Eugene Pauly who lost his memory when he came down with a case of viral encephalitis, but he actually retained some unique behaviors. Can you tell me about him?
Yeah, this is actually one of the first moments that we learn exactly how habits work inside our brain and from a neurological perspective. Because Eugene Pauly, or as he was known in the medical literature, EP, is this very unique individual. He had viral encephalitis, essentially the same virus that causes cold sores. In some very unusual circumstances, it can enter our spinal column and go up into our brain and essentially eat away some of our brain tissue. And the part of the brain that it ate away for Mr. Pauly was the part that stores memory. So he essentially woke up from this fever without the ability to form any new memories whatsoever. His memory lasted until about the 1960s, and this was in the late 1990s or late 80s that this happened. But he had lost 30 years of memories, and if he met you, he would be really pleased to introduce himself and to learn about you, and then a minute later, he would have no idea who you were. He didn't know who his grandchildren were. He didn't know where he lived. He didn't know anything. He did not have the capacity to learn any new facts or form any new memories. But what was particularly interesting is that despite this disability, which lasted the rest of his life, another 20 years or so, he had the ability to form new habits. And so very frequently, if you went into – when doctors went into his house and asked him, if you were hungry, can you tell me what to do? He would say, well, I don't know where the kitchen is. I might go get something to eat, but I'm not sure which door leads to the kitchen. But then if he needed to go to the bathroom, he would stand up, walk across the living room, open up the door to the bathroom, go to the bathroom, wash his hands, close the door, come back and sit down again. And if you asked him, where's the bathroom, he would tell you, I'm not certain which door leads to the bathroom. Because behaviors that had become patterns were stuck in a different part of his brain where habits form rather than memories.
That's fascinating. So what was the part of the brain where these behaviors were lodged?
Well, it's known as the basal ganglia. It's one of the oldest structures within our brain. And basically every brain of any animal almost has this structure, the basal ganglia. And one of the big reasons why it exists is exactly this, to form habits. Because evolutionarily, the ability for your brain to latch onto a pattern, to remember that pattern and execute it automatically, that's incredibly valuable.
Right, because otherwise we'd have to sort of consciously kind of think about each one of these things and, you know, sort of figure out, okay, what am I supposed to do now? Whereas if it just becomes automatic, that I guess it would free up a lot of space in your brain.
That's exactly right. So the fact that you don't have to think about how you walk in the morning or what you should do when you have food in your hand, or the fact that you can get in your car in your driveway and then 20 minutes later you're at your desk at work and you don't really remember exactly how you got there, that frees up your brain to think about inventing fire and aircraft carriers or how to write that memo that's due later on today or just think about anything else. It's a cornerstone of higher cognition.
So do we know how we actually develop habits?
We do. And in fact, this is the big insight, because we're actually living through this golden age of understanding the neurology of habit formation. What we've learned from laboratory experiments is that every habit has three components. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for an automatic behavior to start, and then a routine, which is the behavior itself, and then finally a reward. And the reward is how your brain learns to latch onto that pattern for the future. Now, we've known about this since Pavlov, right, that cues and rewards trigger behaviors. But what we've learned lately that's really interesting is how powerful and subtle these cues and rewards can be. There was a woman named Wendy Wood at Duke University who followed people around for about a year. And what she discovered was that about 40 to 45% of what we do every day is a habit. We might think of it as a decision, but it's actually just an automatic behavior. And in each instance, that habit has not only a cue, but a reward. Something your brain enjoys or finds rewarding that's causing that behavior to become automatic.
And which we probably don't even think about. I mean, there are probably all kinds of cues that just sort of happen at the unconscious level.
Absolutely. And most of the time we don't even have the capacity to recognize them. For instance, pulling your car out of your driveway. One of the things we know from studies is that that's a habit, right? The first time you pulled your car out of your driveway, you really had to concentrate on, you know, where the trash cans are and look in the rearview mirror. After a while, it becomes kind of automatic. And that's because your brain is anticipating a small burst of pleasure it will get when it successfully pulls out into the street. And in fact, we know from neurological studies that happens. Your brain experiences this micro reward as soon as you're in the street. Now, you don't notice that, right? None of us notice that. But that reward is why that behavior can become a habit.
Okay, well, let's talk about how we might develop good habits and get rid of bad habits. Let's say we feel like we're kind of out of shape. We want to start running, but, you know, it's hard to do that. It's hard to kind of, you know, get up the moxie to incorporate that into our regular routine. How do you go about establishing the habit of running?
Well, so I'm really glad you divided this into two categories, because there's the creating a new habit and changing an old habit, and they're a little bit different. So let's talk about creating a new habit, an exercise habit. One of the things that studies have found is that if you give yourself a small reward when you go and do that exercise routine, you're much more likely to do it again. Now, that reward can be, for instance, like a small piece of chocolate or a nice long shower, drinking a smoothie, anything that you actually enjoy. If you give it to yourself right away, then it's much more likely that that exercise routine will become a habit.
In other words, immediately after you come back from your run, you eat some chocolate.
Absolutely, right? And most of us like wait like 20 minutes to pretend like the running and the chocolate aren't actually related. But if you help your brain learn that they are related, then that actually is a great thing. That makes it more likely you're going to start exercising, and that you'll start exercising without the need for that chocolate. But compare that to how most people start an exercise routine, right? You wake up in the morning, you go for a run, you get home, and now like you're late for work and the kids aren't ready for school, so you like rush to get them out the door. You're anxious about getting to your desk. In essence, you're punishing yourself for exercising. And your brain pays attention to whether you punished or rewarded yourself for what you just did.
Well, you also write about sort of one cue you might try is you just put on your running shoes.
Absolutely.
That's sort of, you know, you've planted the idea that you are going to go running, even though if you're not immediately going to get up and go for a run.
That's exactly right. You put your running shoes next to your bed where you see them first thing, right? Or you lay out your running clothes. And within psychology, these are known as implementation intentions. And there's this idea that willpower is kind of like a muscle. It's hard to exert, particularly hard to start. But if you have something that makes it automatic, like for instance, you see your running shoes, or you just tell yourself, tomorrow morning, I'm going to put on my running clothes, and then I'm not even going to go for a run. I'm just going to take them off and get dressed for work. Studies show that if you do this, if you have this implementation intention, once you take that first step, it's much easier to start the routine. And so people who tell themselves, okay, put on your running clothes, you know, just walk around the block, they actually end up going for a jog, because once you're in your running clothes and you're going down the stairs, you might as well just go for a jog, right? It's so easy.
Right.
You're already out there.
Right. And I mean, what you have to do is you have to overcome that initial resistance, you know, that you know, whatever obstacles you throw up. That, you know, once you actually start doing it, you'll be fine.
It's incredibly easy once you start, right? And so the key is choose this obvious cue. This is something simple and easy, like just putting on your running shoes or putting on your running clothes. And then once you actually do the thing that you want to do, and it's fine if that's just going for a walk around the block. That's fine if it's literally just walking down the stairs and back up. Give yourself an immediate reward. Start teaching your brain to make this habit loop, this cue, routine, and reward, by giving yourself the reward that's going to drive that behavior in the future.
Okay, well, let's talk about a different kind of habit, a habit that we want to break. Let's say that we like that alcoholic drink at the end of a long day, and you know we're okay with, you know, maybe one glass of wine, but it very easily slips into three glasses of wine. What can we do to sort of break the overdrinking?
And I will say, I'm a big fan of the one glass of wine. I have two children, so the one glass of wine is pretty important.
You kind of need that one glass, right?
Well, so here's the big insight, I think, about changing habits, which is, and it's known as within psychology, it's known as the golden rule of habit change, which is that once you have a habit, once you've established neural pathways associated with a cue, routine, and reward, it's almost impossible to extinguish those. And we know this from study after study. So instead of thinking of breaking a habit or extinguishing a habit, what you need to think in terms of is changing a bad habit. And what that means is that you need to recognize the cue and the reward and find a new behavior, a new routine that kind of corresponds to that old cue and delivers something similar to that old reward. So let's take having the glass of wine, right? So what often happens is that when I come home from work, the cue is that I'm kind of exhausted and I walk through the door and my kids are like screaming and running around the house. And I think to myself, you know, a glass of wine would be great right now. And so that's my cue. Walking through the door, and the cue, the routine is that I go over, I pour myself a glass of wine. And the reward is that I sort of have this like physical relaxation almost immediately, right? We call it the magic juice around our house, making it sound like I'm an alcoholic. We've got it under control. So then the question becomes, okay, so if the routine is that that's three glasses of wine instead of one glass of wine, what reward are those second two glasses of wine providing to me? And what I would guess, and based on some experience, is that the reward is that it just feels kind of indulgent and luxurious, right? I'm home. If I have two glasses of wine, I can't do any more work that night. And so this is a way of giving myself permission, telling myself, okay, now you can relax. You're done for the day.
Right.
So the question is, can I find another behavior that gives me that same reward but doesn't involve a second or a third glass of wine? And the answer is, of course I can, right? Sometimes it's just as simple as saying, like, I'm going to put my computer away, I'm going to put it in some drawer, and I'm not going to take it out for the rest of the night. That gives me the same reward. Or maybe it's a matter of turning to my wife and saying, hey, you know, what's for dinner? What do you want to watch on TV? Let's be in bed by 10:30. If I can find a new routine that delivers a similar reward to what that second and third glass of wine used to deliver, all of a sudden, I've changed the habit. And in fact, you'll find this all the time, that by diagnosing these cues and rewards, you find a new behavior that kind of makes the urge for the second and third glass of wine just kind of disappear.
What you're saying is that you create a new habit, a better habit.
That's exactly right. And what's important about it, though, is that it still corresponds to that old cue and that old reward. I'm not trying to extinguish things completely. Instead, what I'm trying to do is rechannel these urges.
Well, you write about some remarkable cases of bad habits that really were debilitating for some people. For instance, you tell the story of a young graduate student named Mandy who obsessively bit her fingernails. I mean, to the point where she was having nerve damage. Can you describe how she broke her habit?
Yeah, and this is a fascinating case because nail biting is just something that so many millions of people have trouble with, right? And if you talk to a nail biter, what they'll tell you is that when they bite their nail, it's such an ingrained habit, they don't even notice that their fingers are in their mouth. It just happens automatically. And so the way that we change nail biting, and it's actually one of the most studied habits and easily corrected, is this thing called simplified habit reversal therapy. And what it does is it follows this cue routine reward model. It says, okay, first of all, figure out what the cue is. For most people, nail biting cues are either anxiety or boredom. And so a psychiatrist will tell you, or a psychologist, and this is what they told Mandy, is during the day, carry around a note card. And every single time you feel the urge to bite your nails or you find yourself with your fingers in your mouth, just make a little hash mark on that index card with a pen. This is called cue awareness. What we're trying to do is we're trying to make you aware of what the triggers are that are causing this behavior. And just do that for 3 or 4 days, maybe a week. You know, you're changing a lifelong habit. You can do it slowly. Then the question becomes, okay, so you're aware of the cues, usually boredom or anxiety. Now what do we do to figure out the reward? And rewards are complicated. For most people, and this is true for Mandy, the reward of biting your nails, and this is counterintuitive, is pain. You know, when you bite your nails, you feel that sharp little kind of like sting at the end of your fingers. That actually neurologically is a powerful enough sensation that for a couple of microseconds, it will overwhelm the feeling of boredom or anxiety. And so boredom or anxiety is so tension-filled that people's brains would prefer to feel a moment of pain to overwhelm that boredom or anxiety. And that's the reward. And so then the question becomes, okay, so if we need a new behavior that delivers that reward, what is it? And what they found is that they tell people sometimes to put a rubber band on their wrist and snap the rubber band when they feel the urge to bite their nails, or just to scratch their arm kind of roughly. Anything that gives you this kind of physical intense sensation, that's delivering a similar reward. That's going to overwhelm the sense of boredom or anxiety.
So what did Mandy do?
That's exactly what Mandy did. So for a week, she carried around this card where she would make a hash mark every single time she felt the urge to bite her nails or found herself biting her nails. And within about 4 days, she figured out what her cues were. It was basically when she was bored in class or when she was watching TV. And then the doctor told her, okay, now this time, every single time you make that hash mark, every time you feel the urge, just go and scratch your arm kind of roughly and then make a check on your card. A check means you just did great. You avoided biting your nails. She did that for about a week. And at first, it wasn't perfect, right? She missed a lot of times. But by the end of the week, about 80% of the time, instead of biting her nails, she was scratching her arm and making a check on a card. She felt really good about herself. Her nails started looking better. And what's amazing is that 3 weeks later, she wasn't scratching or biting.
And she had, and this was a lifetime problem that she'd had.
Oh, this was a huge problem. She had like sought like counseling for it before. I mean, think about how bad it has to be to biting your nails to go talk to a psychologist at your school about it. Here's the thing that's interesting that this shows, though, is that habits are incredibly powerful, but they're also incredibly delicate. You just change the context around them. You change those cues and rewards, and you can change the habit. And that's how habit change happens.
Yeah. Now, not surprisingly, corporations have figured out how to tap into people's habits and, you know, develop habits that would cause them to buy their product. And there are some famous stories along these lines. And you tell one about Pepsodent, the toothpaste company. What did they do that made them so successful some decades ago?
Well, this is totally fascinating. And Pepsodent is actually the toothpaste that essentially created American toothbrushing habits, right? We all brush our teeth now and think nothing of it. But if you went back 90 years ago, almost no one in the U.S. brushed their teeth, and no one did on a daily basis. It was considered something that, like, you did, like, once a week if you're kind of highfalutin. And then this guy named this ad man named Claude Hopkins, he started pitching this stuff called Pepsodent. And this toothpaste. And what he told people was that he told them to look for this cue, that if you felt a film on your teeth, you should feel bad about that. Now, up till then, nobody cared about a film on their teeth, right? It wasn't something anyone felt bad about. But once he started advertising that only sort of the low class has film on their teeth, all of a sudden people became paranoid about it. And the thing about a film on your tooth is that if I tell you to run your tongue along your teeth, you'll do it, right? Everyone does it. You do it almost unconsciously, and you feel that film. And he said, look, the way that you get rid of it is you brush with Pepsodent. Now, the truth of the matter is brushing with anything, even just eating an apple, will get rid of the film. But in Pepsodent, they had put this special chemical called sodium lauthate, which is kind of – and as well as mint extracts. And what they are, there's these irritants that make your gums tingle. And so when people would brush with Pepsodent, their gums would tingle and their tongue would tingle a little bit. And he told them, this is what clean feels like. And people began to crave that feeling, right? I'm sure you and your listeners probably do too. When you walk out of the door in the morning and your teeth kind of don't have that tingling sensation, sort of feel a little bit unclean.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of my I'm ready for the day after I've brushed my teeth because, you know, it's like, whoa, my mouth feels fresh.
What's fascinating, though, is that tingling, that's because there's an irritant in your toothpaste that makes your gums tingle. It has nothing to do with cleaning your teeth. Shampoo is similar. They add chemicals to shampoo to make those big suds so that when you're washing your hair, you see all those bubbles. That has nothing to do with actually the cleaning properties of shampoo. Most shampoo, if you used it without that additive, wouldn't create bubbles, but it would make your hair just as clean. But people need some type of reward that shows that the product is working. And companies know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the appeal is emotional. I mean, it's kind of visceral. It's not any sort of – it's not logical about what this is going to do for you.
It's not logical. But it is neurological, right? It's interesting because what it takes advantage of is this craving that we have to create patterns with anything that delivers a reward. And so if I tell you that the tingling means your teeth are clean, that will create a toothbrushing habit. If I tell you that all those suds mean that you're really cleaning your hair, it'll create a shampoo habit. And that's really powerful.
Now, there's another story you tell from the corporate world that it's a very different kind of lesson. It has to do with Alcoa, the aluminum company of America, which sort of totally transformed itself by making one particular change. What happened there?
Well, this is one of my favorite stories because it deals with this concept known as keystone habits, which what scientists have found is that not all habits are created equal. some habits, when they start to change, they set off this chain reaction that changes other patterns in people's lives as well. And within psychology, these are known as keystone habits. And at Alcoa, as you mentioned, Paul O'Neill, who later became Treasury Secretary, was appointed a CEO of Alcoa. And Alcoa was this huge aluminum company, 165,000 employees, plants all over the world. And the plants were really dangerous. And when he came in, he said, look, my top priority here isn't to increase profits or to increase efficiency. Instead, my top priority is to change worker safety habits. Well, Wall Street kind of freaked out, right? Investors said, look, in fact, one guy told me that he listened to Paul O'Neill say that. He ran out of the room. He called his top investors and he said, sell your Alcoa stock. They just appointed a hippie to run the company. But what Paul O'Neill suspected was that if he could change people's worker safety habits, employees' worker safety habits, that would be a keystone habit. It would set off a chain reaction that would cause them to produce better aluminum faster. And that's exactly what happened.
Wow. So this really did change the welfare of the company?
Alcoa, within 3 years of Paul O'Neill's appointment, became the top performer in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And what's amazing is that Paul never talked about profits. He never talked about efficiency. Instead, he said, we're going to solve worker safety. He actually had a rule that he didn't want anyone to ever get a paper cut working for Alcoa. Now, when you make aluminum, it's super dangerous. People died doing this all the time. And he said, we're not even going to have a paper cut happen here. He never actually achieved that. But the focus on that level of worker safety habits, it changed everything about how people worked. And as a result, everything got better.
These keystone habits, does that also apply at the individual level?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things we know is that when people create kind of what's known as quantum change, large life changes in a relatively short period of time, it's usually because they've identified a keystone habit and have changed it. So exercise is a great example. You know, there's all these studies that show that when people start exercising habitually, they tend to eat better. And that makes sense, right? Their eating habits change because they feel good about their body. But on average, when people start exercising, they also use their credit cards less. They procrastinate about 20% less at work. They do their dishes, on average, about 30 minutes earlier in the day. Now, no one makes this connection in their mind between I'm going to start running in the morning and I'm going to do my dishes earlier, right? Most people are totally unaware of that. But what's happening is that for many people, exercise is a keystone habit because when they start exercising, it changes almost subconsciously their self-image of themselves. They start thinking of themselves as the type of person who goes running. And that type of person doesn't procrastinate. They don't put off doing their dishes. They're the kind of person who like keeps their credit card in their wallet and doesn't splurchase at the grocery store. So for individuals, keystone habits are incredibly powerful. And the key to figuring out what your keystone habit is, because it differs from person to person and place to place, is look for those types of change that you think are going to change your self-image. Look for those types of change that are like a little bit irrationally scary, like going running in the morning when you're not used to it, or you know, eating a salad for lunch instead of a sandwich. Those types of changes that seem to have an emotional component, those will subtly shift your self-image and set off a chain reaction that changes other patterns in your life.
Now, we've been mostly talking about fairly benign habits, but what about more serious habits? I mean, more what we would call addictions, gambling, smoking. Do the same rules apply?
Absolutely. And if you talk to the American Academy of Addiction Specialists, their definition of addiction actually incorporates habit dysfunction. Because there's some things that we can look at and we can say, oh, that's a chemical addiction, right? Heroin, for instance, or even nicotine. Think about gambling addictions or sex addictions or food addictions. In many of those, there's actually not even a chemical entering your body. So how does gambling become an addiction? And the answer is that for many of those, they're actually habit dysfunctions, including smoking. Smoking is a great example because nicotine is addictive, but it's actually less addictive than most people think. According to studies, about 100 hours after your last cigarette, once the nicotine is out of your blood system, you're no longer physically addicted to cigarettes. And yet we all know people who crave a cigarette a week or a month or years after giving them up. If you crave a cigarette years after you quit smoking, that's not because of a physical addiction. That's because of a habit dysfunction.
Okay, but habits and addiction. So what do you do about that then?
Well, habits and addiction live in the same parts of our brain. And so the way that you handle it is you recognize the rewards that those addictive substances used to give you. So take cigarettes, for instance. You know, most people will say, well, I'd sit down in the morning and I would have a cigarette with my morning coffee, and I loved doing that. And so the question is, what was the cigarette providing in the morning? Was it that was a break? Because obviously you can take a break and sort of relax anytime. Was it a burst of energy that nicotine provides because it is a stimulant? In which case, having, you know, a double espresso instead of just a cup of coffee, that might feed that urge the same way. Is it that smoking is an inherently social activity? For most people, they smoke with others. And that now that you don't smoke, you don't have that social opportunity anymore? Is it that smoking used to be this break of your day? You would divide up your day into half-hour segments, and now without cigarettes, you just work for 3 hours straight. Once you figure out what reward the cigarettes were providing, and you come up with something else, some alternative routine that provides a similar reward, study after study shows that is how an addiction like cigarettes, that's how it's fought.
What about gambling? How would you break the gambling habit or addiction?
Well, a lot of it, again, has to do with what reward is it delivering, right? So for some people, they gamble because they crave this risk-taking. And we've come to demonize risk-taking, but many, many people, in fact, according to studies, probably about a quarter of the population, human population, crave some type of regular risk-taking in their lives. And so if gambling provided that and you don't want to gamble anymore because you've been gambling too much, you need to find something else that provides some sense of risk-taking. For some people, that might be, you know, having intense conversations with friends that feels kind of risky. Or a very well-known author I know, mountain climbs on a regular basis. And for him, the mountain climbing is kind of dangerous. He does it 3 times a week, and he could fall. And for him, that's enough to satisfy that. Or is it that the gambling is providing some type of entertainment for you, right? And it feels like productive entertainment because you might win some money. Once you recognize that the reward is entertainment, then you can find something new that provides that same thrill.
So it sounds like you need to figure out, you need to diagnose yourself. So in other words, just as this urge to gamble starts, you stop and you think, okay, what's going on here? You know, why do I want to do this?
That's exactly right. Or even afterwards, it's hard in the heat of the moment sometimes to analyze it. But you're exactly right. The self-diagnosing, figuring out these cues and these rewards that shape our lives, that is the first and most important step into making a change. You know, we've been taught to think of habits as this behavior. And we've been taught to think of them as something that sort of is outside the realm of reason, that they just happen and we're powerless over them. But every study shows that that's not true, that you can sit down and you can break the habit up into parts. You can fiddle with its gears. And when you do, you learn how to change it.
Now, you also write about something that I wouldn't have necessarily sort of put in the same category of habits. It's what you call social habits that can actually play a profound role in social movements. I mean, you say that, you know, what Rosa Parks did, you know, refusing to give up her bus seat on a Montgomery, Alabama bus, you know, obviously, you know, one of the pivotal moments in the early civil rights movement. You say this is partly a story of habits.
Of social habits. Yeah, it's really interesting because if you look at when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, the interesting question is, why did that spark the Montgomery bus boycott, right, which is the birth of the modern civil rights movement, the introduction of Martin Luther King to the nation? Because earlier that year, there had been two other African-American women who had refused to give up their seats on buses in Montgomery. The previous year, there had been another two people. And none of those actually sparked any massive changes. And the reason why Rosa Parks was so influential, why her act of defiance sparked a movement, is because Rosa Parks was embedded in the Montgomery culture in a way that nobody else really was. She had friends that crossed the social spectrum, whites, blacks, poor, rich. And all of them felt this sort of social obligation, a sense of social habit towards Rosa Parks. So when you think about it, the Montgomery bus boycott lasted an entire year. Imagine walking to work instead of taking a bus that goes past you on the street for an entire year. What would it take to get you to give up taking a bus and walking to work. Now, if you knew Rosa Parks, maybe it's the habit of friendship, right? And that makes sense. But if you don't know Rosa Parks, if you just know if she's a friend of a friend or a friend of a friend of a friend, what gets you and the entire black community in Montgomery took part in the boycott? What gets you to stay off that bus? Peer pressure. The social habits of a community around peer pressure. You don't want to be the one person who can be seen getting on that bus and riding past everyone else who's walking to work. And what we know about how peer pressure works is that it follows the same basic pattern of cue, routine, and reward. We've diagrammed this out. And it's a very fascinating way to think about how societies work because they rely on social norms, which are actually social habits.
So what are the policy takeaways in all of this research? I mean, let's say the U.S. government wants to get a lot of people to stop smoking or to curb overeating. What can be done?
Well, there's a lot of fascinating research on exactly that question, and a lot of new policies are being implemented in light of what we know. The first thing is to teach people to recognize their own habits, right? To teach them to understand how these cues and rewards work. You know, the FDA recently passed rules. One of the FDA recently passed rules saying that restaurant chains are going to have to post calorie counts, right, on their menus. That started in New York. Mayor Bloomberg actually had a rule saying that every chain has to say how many calories are in each item. And the idea was to try and help people who particularly live in disadvantaged communities eat more healthily. The evidence is very unclear as to whether it worked. And one of the reasons why is because despite telling people how many calories are in a Big Mac, they didn't actually help people understand why they were why they had a compulsion to eat a Big Mac or something unhealthy as opposed to a healthier option. And so one of the things that's happening as these new rules are being rolled out is that there's going to be a lot of education campaigns around teaching people, when you see that something has high calories, higher calories than you expected, here's how to make use of that information. And part of it is for you to understand and recognize that you might have an urge for something that's high calorie and that simply having a salad isn't going to necessarily suffice. But you can find something that's in between, right? Something that's in between 1,000 calories and 300 calories or 200 calories. You can find a healthier option. The other thing that we can do is that we can help people understand, we can help people understand that they need to enjoy the rewards that they give themselves. There's there's something unique about the American character that we sort of want to be self-denying of rewards. And so we feel like when we go for a run, we shouldn't eat a piece of chocolate because we shouldn't pat ourselves on the back. But telling people, look, it's okay, here's a reward for you. The only way you create a good habit is by actually enjoying this reward, letting yourself enjoy it. That's incredibly important. And so public policy now is beginning to reflect that by asking people to reflect on the rewards that they're getting and giving them time to actually enjoy them.
So how much does this whole research hit home for you? Have you actually changed anything that you do based on what you learned?
Yeah, no, I've actually changed a huge number of habits in my life. I exercise every day and I run every day. And in fact, my wife just did the New York City Marathon a couple of months ago, and I'll be doing it later this year.
And you were not a runner before.
I was not a runner. I was not particularly good at running before, and I was scared of running, right? It's scary to like wake up and think like, I'm going to go run 6 miles and I'll look like an idiot the entire way. So giving myself rewards was really important part of that, or even just small rewards. Like I used to go eat a cookie every afternoon at the New York Times where I'm a reporter. I'd go to the cafeteria. And when I was talking to researchers and trying to understand why I had this habit, they said, first of all, figure out what the cue was. And I figured out it was a time of day. It was the afternoon. And then they said, figure out what the reward is. And I said, well, the reward's a cookie. A cookie's really yummy. And they said, no. Rewards are more complicated than that. Is it that, you're hungry, in which case an apple should work just as well, or you need a break from work, in which case taking a walk around the block should do the trick? And what I realized after doing some experiments is that I was going up to the cafeteria to get a cookie because that's when I would see my friends and I would gossip for 15 or 20 minutes with them. And so now every afternoon I stand up and I go find someone to gossip with outside of the cafeteria and we gossip for whoever happens to be out of earshot. And the cookie urge is totally gone. And I've lost like between the running and the cookies, I've lost like 28 or 29 pounds. So it's been very effective. But it's even more importantly, it's a kind of an outlook. It's just feeling like you have control over these parts of your life, almost half your life, 40 to 45% of your life. These parts of your life that feel sort of outside of your immediate grasp, feeling like you can control that, and anyone can. It feels really, it feels nice.